I used to teach The Problems of Philosophy by Bertrand Russell when I would teach intro classes of some kind, or I taught it a few times, right? And that is like a really hard book to teach undergrads, even though tons of like philosophers tell you that's a great way to introduce people to analytic philosophy.
Yeah.
And what I found that what I did was actually I had to reverse something where I made them read the final chapter first, which is where Russell talks about the value of philosophy. And it's about how like we're going to discover that the world is an interesting and diverse and strange place in a way that we never would have imagined had we not asked these questions to begin with. And I'm like, now with that in mind, we're going to talk about Desdemona Loves Cassio over, like over and over, right? Now with that in mind, we're going to talk about knowledge by acquaintance, you know, like these sorts of concepts. And that seemed to help them a little bit, right?
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Penses. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. This episode's a very, very special one. I have with me Dr. Jared Henderson, and we're going to be talking about public philosophy. What is that? What is philosophy in general? Analytic philosophy versus public philosophy. It's going to be awesome. I'm really excited about it. I can barely hold myself in. Before we jump in, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon and YouTube members. If you guys like this show, help me keep the lights on, help me, you know, feed my dogs and justify this to my friends and family. That would be huge. If you guys want to see me around, please become a Patreon patron or a YouTube member. You can get different perks at different levels. You can find the links in the description wherever you're getting this podcast at. Not too much commodification of myself today. You can find us in Facebook, in the Facebook group Parker's Penses Penseurs. A lot of my guests are there, and we have amazing conversations, a lot on the philosophy of AI right now, so that's pretty cool. And there's a lot of other ways to find me, all the socials. I'm all over the place. Still trying to figure out how to respond back to you folks. So if you don't get a message right back, eventually in the next couple months, but hopefully sooner. All right, let's stop doing that, and let's get in with Dr. Jared Henderson and talk about philosophy. Jared, well, thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man. This is awesome.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Dude, I don't even know where to start. So you have a PhD in philosophy, and it's an emphasis in analytic philosophy, and it's like the analytic of analytic philosophy, because it's on theories of truth and logic, and like even the analytic philosophers is like, I don't know. That's pretty analytic, man.
Yeah. So my dissertation was on theories of truth, and particularly a kind of like language first approach to doing theories of truth.
Yeah.
And in particular, a kind of like formal linguistic approach to doing a language first approach to theories of truth.
Yeah.
The paper that I consider to be sort of the core of my dissertation was this chapter called Truth and Great Ability, where I defend like a degree theoretic theory of truth. So truth. There are some things that are less true than others, but aren't totally false, these sorts of things. And I base the whole thing out of linguistic evidence, right? And then try to give a formal semantic theory that's consistent with other theories of gradable adjectives, and then say, if the way that we talk about truth is reflective of what truth is, here is what the metaphysics would look like. It's not surprising that that kind of paper got published eventually in the Journal of Philosophical Logic.
Yeah.
Right. I guess you could say that I tried to just go for the most analytic type of analytic philosophy that you could do in a PhD.
Yeah. So I've done several episodes on the metaphysics of truth, some like epistemology type stuff of truth. So a lot of my audience is going to be like, well, correspondence theory. And I thought we could just touch on that real quick before we move on. How would like a deflationary account, maybe you wouldn't characterize yours as a deflationary account, but a language first account, make sense or compare with like a just facts account of correspondence, maybe. Yep.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So my theory, actually, I eventually, kind of the follow-up chapter of that dissertation, I give like a metaphysical theory of truth that's consistent with sort of my linguistic theory. And actually, I call it a version of the correspondence theory.
Nice.
So I do think that fundamentally what truth is reflecting the way that the world is or corresponding. I don't, however, say that truth is correspondence to the facts, because I don't have facts in my ontology. I have objects in my ontology. I have objects with properties in my ontology. And then I have propositions which represent things in particular ways. There's actually a really good book by Kuna called, I believe, Conceptions of Truth. It's been a little while since I read that book. And he gives, it's this classic sort of German style book that's like, I will give you a theory of truth subtly while actually giving you a complete history of theories of truth, at least in Western philosophy.
Awesome.
And so this is where he's going to talk about Hegel. He's going to talk about Aquinas. He's going to talk about Frege, Russell, blah. Yeah, he just goes through it all. And it's really comprehensive. And if you're interested in theories of truth, it's one of those books that's probably not cited enough, to be honest, because of how comprehensive it is. And a point that he made that I really latched onto in my dissertation was that correspondence theories did not always posit facts as a separate thing in their ontology. So actually, when Frege talks about correspondence, he uses this cathedral as an example. He actually talks about the proposition representing the thing, like representing an object. So I call mine an object-based correspondence theory or an objectual correspondence theory.
And Frege called those propositions thoughts, right?
He did call those propositions.
Yeah, that was so confusing for me at first. And then I figured out, I was like, okay, I think I like that. That's good.
Yeah. So my view, I didn't take a stand on the nature of propositions in my dissertation.
Yeah.
In fact, I actually saw it as a kind of virtue of my theory that I didn't have to take a stand on what the primary truth bearers were, whether those are thoughts, as in things in the head, propositions, as in mind-independent representational entities, or sentences. The important part was that whatever the primary truth bearer was, it was the sort of thing that could represent objects.
Yeah.
And I sort of argue for neutrality on that point, like that we should not take a stand on the primary truth bearers if we can avoid it. Certain theories kind of seem to require taking certain primary truth bearers as primary and everything else is derivative.
Yeah.
So in a case of the case for this would be propositions are primary as mind independent representational entities. That's sort of a standard view.
Yeah.
And then sentences represent things insofar as they express propositions.
Totally.
So
I love it.
Derivative. It's derivative of propositions. I just said, I don't take a stand on this at all. I wanted to remain neutral. Remaining neutral on big debates is a virtue if you can avoid it. So so I do hold to a correspondence theory of truth. I started graduate school actually as a fairly committed deflationist.
Okay.
I was like a pretty hardcore deflationist. And then I had this kind of one-off conversation with someone who was on my dissertation committee, Magdalena Kaufman, who's a semanticist. She's in the linguistics department. University of Connecticut was great for interdisciplinary work like this. We had a great logic group with mathematicians and logicians and linguists. And she kind of mentioned, she's like, oh, yeah, you know, no one ever noticed in the literature that actually the truth predicate can take modifiers that would suggest it's a gradable adjective. And, you know, someone should talk about that. And she said that to me at like a conference we were holding at UConn near the end of the spring semester. And that summer, I just thought about it a lot.
Yeah.
And then I started kind of putting the idea forward. I would tell it to, there's this philosopher who was at UConn at the time. He's still there, but he's close to retirement, I believe. Bill Lycan, William Lycan.
I was
talking to Bill Lycan at a barbecue. And he was like, well, you're just one of those deflationists, right? Bill's view is actually called, I believe, meta-maxi-minimalism, which is that it's very, or maxi-meta-minimalism. It is very important that we don't take a stand on what truth is what his view. He just doesn't care, actually, about the nature of truth.
Wow.
But he kind of jokingly said, you're one of those deflationists. And I said, well, Bill, I actually don't know if I'm a deflationist anymore, because I've been thinking about this idea that truth is a thing that comes in degrees because it takes certain modifiers as like the predicate. So it just doesn't behave like the deflationists say that it behaves. And he looked at me and he's like, that's a good idea. Like, and occasionally when someone tells you like, that's a good idea, you should pursue it. And that just,
especially someone like that.
Right. And Bill and I, and in fact, my first publication was defending deflationism against a paper, a very influential paper by Dorit Baron, Bill Lycan, and their PhD student at the time, Claire Horisk. And I had written a response paper to that. So they had thought I was just a hardcore deflationist still, but I kind of came around, and I kind of joked that at UConn, like, lots of people work on theories of truth. Michael Lynch is there, and that's when he was doing like his truth pluralism stuff. He was on my committee. We had Stuart Shapiro, who had come in and had worked on some stuff on truth. He was on my committee. Keith Simmons, who was my dissertation advisor, had worked on truth. Wow. We also had Lionel Shapiro, who had worked on deflationism, J.C. Beal, who had worked on deflationism, who I worked with pretty closely, just all of these people who had worked on truth. And I got to go into my dissertation defense and say, I have a theory of truth. And one consequence of my theory is that every single one of you is wrong. and which made it just like for a really fun time. Now, did I convince any of them? Absolutely not. But it was a lot of fun. And it was really kind of transformative to go from being a deflationist about truth to becoming a fairly robust correspondence theorist. Now, I'm not a pluralist. I'm a monist about truth. I have this, and I'm like a, in a way, I say that I'm actually defending like the most traditional version of truth you could have, in the sense that it kind of makes sense of things that Aristotle and Aquinas would say, while also capturing a sort of natural language observation about how we use the truth predicate.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's an extra benefit. That's huge. Okay. Some of the audience is lost. You guys don't worry about it. We're going to get into public philosophy. I did this mostly to demonstrate that Jared is an analytic of analytics, even there'll be a rhetorical point there later. But Jared, so just real quick, you said something about propositions. I can't remember the exact words, but they're like primary maybe. Do you take a stand on whether or not they're like structured?
No, I have no version of propositions, or like no view of propositions. I used to care. I had this one idea that deflationism and structureless propositions were like these really natural pairings, and that it was really easy to be a deflationist.
Yeah.
Actually, there's like a really good argument for deflationism if propositions aren't structured, which is that the proposition that P denotes a set of worlds, and the proposition that P is true denotes the same set of worlds. Or the proposition that P is true denotes that same set of worlds. And so the truth predicate adds no content in that way. And so you get a kind of almost quick version of an argument for deflationism. I don't know if anyone ever thought that was a good argument when I gave it. But I kind of thought there was something there. It just was something I never pursued.
I thought JC made an argument like that on the podcast. I'll have to go back and listen, but he was doing some fun stuff with the truth predicate.
He might have done that. I mean, he has this view that what truth is, logically speaking, is like the null operator.
Yeah, yeah, right?
It's the operator that does nothing, except get you into a lot of logical trouble. it's sort of simpatico with what JC might say. On those issues. So I had like for a little while a view of this. I liked the structuralist view of propositions as well for a little while, because it was basically the view of propositions that you find in semantics. And if you take this sort of if you believe that semantics is a science, and you believe that like philosophy should sort of make sense of our best scientific theories of various phenomena, then it would seem like the best theory of propositions kind of follows that it's structureless propositions. But that's contested enough in semantics as well that you'll find structured proposition theorists in there as well. Craig Roberts uses Phrygian senses in some of her theories.
That's my thing.
Under discussions and
stuff. I love that. So, I love that. Yeah. I study philosophy of religion, so I'm like, anytime I can like put this in contact with the mind of God, and these are propositions or thoughts, right? And they're composed of concepts, and those are Phrygian senses, and now we got an argument here, maybe. But yeah, that's for another time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so Jared, all this, man, we just like blew up the audience's mind and probably ruined the YouTube analytics here. But you went from that, and now you left the academy. You're doing work in the digital world, I think, and or in the tech space, and you're like this public philosopher phenom on YouTube. How the heck? Like, what happened?
Well, I left academia because of the job market. I never went on the academic job market. I had a job lined up a year before I had my dissertation, and I decided to pursue it. It paid well, and it didn't seem like it would be mind-numbingly dumb. And it let me move to Austin, which was one of the cities I was willing to move to. So I sort of, it checked a lot of boxes. I know that there were people who knew me who were disappointed that I didn't go try, right? Everyone kind of has this conception in philosophy maybe less so now, but that like you should really try. It's like that's what you're training to be, right? As a professional
right.
philosopher.
Right.
And I was just very pessimistic about my odds on the market. At the time, I had one publication. No, and then I was like working on my second, which was a paper with JC. Yeah. And then I had like a third kind of lined up, but that took a year to publish after I left graduate school, actually.
Wow.
And that was my degrees of truth stuff.
Yeah.
I had the sort of so maybe with three publications I would have stood a chance, but there was someone who like, was like 2 years ahead of me at UConn who had like a really similar profile to me in a lot of ways and was a guy I really looked up to. We were very good friends in grad school, and he went on the market a lot and he just never got interviews. Like he wasn't even getting interviews. And I thought like, well, this is a guy who's very similar to me in a lot of regards. So the market might just not want me. And so I was just kind of pragmatic about it. I also have some like criticisms of the way academia sort of forces you to be highly transient well into your 30s, sometimes even into your 40s, in a way that's like really hard to establish like lasting friendships or build a family or do, you know, it, or just like know people, like know your neighbors.
Even just like finding a spouse. Yeah. A lot of my friends are having a hard time with that.
So like all of this stuff made it less attractive. Though, like, I love philosophy. Like, I genuinely love philosophy. And if I had seen a path where I could have done it professionally in the academy, I would have continued to do so. And it was great. I think at the time when people asked me, I said something like, well, I don't really like teaching. I came to realize that was not true. I actually, looking back, have a lot of fond memories about it. And now, in some sense, what I do is teaching.
Totally.
Right? When you look online. So you add all of, like that together, it just didn't seem like it was like a viable life path. And so I had a really solid alternative. Many people don't leave and go the adjuncting route or do all this other stuff because they don't have a clear alternative. And I was one of like the fortunate ones who just had one. Right. Yeah. So I took it. And that was, I think overall probably was the most prudent decision.
Yeah.
Did it feel like breaking up? You know, you go through a period of like depression basically where, and things, yeah, you know, and you go through various stages about it. Like, well, maybe I didn't like philosophy ever, you know, something like this for a while. You're wondering, you know, you do all this. But I love philosophy. I still read philosophy all the time. I don't read as many journals these days just because it's hard to keep up. But I read a lot of philosophy. I think about philosophy. I talk about philosophy. It's like my one true intellectual love. And, you know, the tech stuff gets me, you know, makes me a decent living. And I've moved a couple of times since like my first job out of grad school, but that's normal in the tech world. And it's mentally stimulating in a way that's fun. I actually work with another philosophy PhD. My first job was a bunch of philosophy PhDs who all work in AI. My current job, my two closest collaborators, one of them is an undergrad in philosophy who was like an ABD in a different kind of program and then left to do library science stuff and then found his way to tech. And the other guy is a PhD in philosophy who worked on like decision theory. So he and I, like the three of us, you know, we still talk about philosophy all the time. So
that's awesome. Are you using your logic stuff? Are you doing logic?
Oh yeah, all the time. I'm my day job is like as an ontologist is like my title.
Nice,
I build conceptual models using like graph databases of like metadata and stuff with like semantic rules, necessary and sufficient conditions, all kinds of stuff like that. So I use some of those logic chops that you had to build. I mean, compared to what you would do if you were like writing logic papers still, it's fairly simple, but you also have to deal with a lot of the messiness of the real world while you're doing it. Yeah. But yeah, I get to use sort of my philosophy stuff basically.
That's awesome. So I hear that all the time. I first learned about that through like Lex Friedman a few years back and him talking about ontologies. I'm like, well, I know that word. And then talking about, you know, PhDs in philosophy coming in with logics. And I was like, wait, I know this stuff. And it's just really cool to put a face to it that like you're one of the folks out there doing it. I love that. So you've done a little bit of work on analytic theology. I'll point folks to your Phil People page. You got a paper there with JC. I just want to wave at the fact that you're Eastern Orthodox. That's kind of cool for the audience, for who knows Jared otherwise. Like that's a pretty cool thing. That explains some of his reading interests, probably. You'll see like C.S. Lewis and stuff in there, and that's awesome. But you are also married to a philosophy grad student. Is she working on a PhD or master's?
She's very close to finishing her dissertation. So awesome. I will soon be married to another PhD in philosophy.
what's her area of expertise or emphasis there?
She works on mostly expressivism, so philosophy of language and metaethics.
And okay, so this is like a real practical note for a lot of my philosophy grad student friends, master's and PhD students who are looking for spouses and stuff. They ask me all the time. I don't talk a whole ton of philosophy with my wife. It's mostly like, I read this, I have to dump this on you. But I wanted to hear from you, man. Do you guys sit around and just talk philosophy all the time or what?
Yeah, we talk about philosophy all the time. Wow. I mean, we don't only talk about philosophy, but
yeah,
we talk about philosophy all the time. Yeah.
Did you guys meet in?
We met in grad school.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice, man. Okay. So that is.
She was like 2 years behind me at the University of Connecticut, and that's where we met. We started dating after a couple months.
So she's in dissertation writing. You don't have to be on campus taking classes when you're
once you're far enough along, you don't have to. So she's in Austin, and we just got along really well. We met, we started dating. I think we got engaged fairly quickly, especially by like the standards that you might a lot of people in academia. I think we got engaged after like 9 or 10 months, and then we were married a year later. Yeah.
Which is like, it's real quick for academia probably, and a little slow for like the Christian community. Like, hey, what was taking so long, man?
Yeah, yeah. It's nothing like these like people I know that are like, I'm on my third date. I think I found the one, you know?
Yeah, I got a ring already.
It's nothing like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, okay. So you moved into like the public sphere of philosophy. We've been using this word a lot. And one thing I like to ask my philosophy, especially PhD guests, is just what is philosophy? Can you give us a necessary and sufficient conditions or like a conceptualization of it?
Yeah, I probably can't give you necessary and sufficient conditions.
Right.
I mean, I tend to have a very, very permissive view of what philosophy is these days. I probably had less of a permissive view when I was in the academy, but I also didn't think a lot about what it was while I was doing it.
Yeah.
But I tend to think of philosophy is primarily asking, or it's like a philosophy is a certain kind of rigorous approach to asking non-empirical questions. This is one of the ways I would characterize philosophy. So I think that does not mean that philosophy cannot be empirically informed, right? But it is not asking the sorts of questions that simply are matters of fact in the sort of empirical sense that we could do these. I just think that's probably the easiest way to characterize this. That actually contests what philosophy of language is in a lot of places, especially when you're doing such heavy interactions with semantics.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I kind of saw myself as doing a kind of like quasi-empirical work in the semantics field and then always trying to find those like philosophical consequences and applications, which strictly speaking weren't empirical matters. But, you know, philosophy is also characterized by, probably partly characterized by a kind of history of asking certain sorts of questions. We can point to Plato. There are non-Western examples too. So the matter of like pure lineage is like not exactly easy to characterize either. And there's kind of a spirit to philosophy in the sense of like, it's people who ask the questions that other people want to dismiss as obvious or pointless.
You
get all of these together and you start to get some kind of cluster concept of what philosophy is.
Yeah. The cluster, it's always tough for me because I think of like we mentioned Frege earlier, and I love Frege. I love the Germans like around that time period. Husserl, another one. I'm not a big fan of Heidegger, but Husserl is awesome. And then you think like, okay, but what about like Camus? And you're like, he's writing just novels. And if you ask anyone on Instagram, Camus is like the philosopher of all philosophers, or Nietzsche. Yeah, but it's like, what about Frege? And like, who is Frege? What are you talking about? But you go into philosophy of language and Frege is the man. And they're like, oh, I don't even read Camus. It's just so funny that this one term can capture both of those camps.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I do actually think that there's something to actually, if we talk about sort of the continental analytic split a bit here, which is like always been a little artificial, especially if you like Husserl. Michael Dummett's got this great little book on like the origins of analytical philosophy and mentions that when Husserl's writing, I think it's the Logical Investigations, and Frege is writing the Foundations of Arithmetic, that there is no point in which continental and analytic philosophy were ever closer, right?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're sort of these founding people. And so like the founders were working on very similar problems and ideas, and then it just kind of splits in a weird way. One of the reasons that I think that people on like Instagram love Camus, if you go on like my Discord server, lots of people love Nietzsche, lots of people love Camus, you know, lots of people are into like the existentialist and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think part of it is because it does feel like those philosophers are like talking about your life in a way that feels important. And I actually want to say like that probably is important.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to find analytic philosophers who are writing in a way that you could read them and you would think this matters to me as I sort of like go and live. Yeah. Right. I find the puzzles that analytic philosophers work on to be fascinating and interesting. But I think that analytic philosophy siloed itself for a long time in a way that made it very difficult for people to latch onto it if they weren't really kind of invested in the project already.
Yeah.
You know, I used to teach The Problems of Philosophy by Bertrand Russell when I would teach intro classes of some kind, or I taught it a few times, right? And that is like a really hard book to teach undergrads, even though tons of like philosophers tell you that's a great way to introduce people to analytic philosophy.
Yeah.
And what I found that what I did was actually I had to reverse something where I made them read the final chapter first, which is where Russell talks about the value of philosophy. And it's about how like we're going to discover that the world is an interesting and diverse and strange place in a way that we never would have imagined had we not asked these questions to begin with. And I'm like, now with that in mind, we're going to talk about Desdemona Loves Cassio like over and over, right? Now with that in mind, we're going to talk about knowledge by acquaintance, like these sorts of concepts. And that seemed to help them a little bit, right? That we're studying the really strange world that we live in. And so, you know, I think that's slightly changed philosophy in the academy, like in the analytic world, definitely took like a social turn, like kind of while I was in grad school. I think still to some extent,
oh, yeah,
lots of people want to write on like sort of social issues or social epistemology or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's like a little bit easier for people to latch onto. So maybe this sort of weird divergence will end. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, frankly, also, like Camus is just a more pleasurable writer to read than Frege. You might like love Frege. I love Frege.
Yeah.
I had one professor in graduate school who I love very dearly who would say, you know, I only read philosophers and that's why I start with Frege. Like was like kind of his like his joke. But Frege's not fun. You know, Frege might be thrilling in some like intellectual sense, but he's not like fun to read.
Yeah, and you got to figure out what these terms mean too. Yeah,
yeah, and like, but reading The Plague is fun, right?
Yeah.
So even if it's heavy, and certain continental philosophers, or especially in the existentialist world, just seem to have that capacity. That it's not necessarily the case that analytic philosophers have ever really done. That's also one note. I think there are some ethicists in the analytic world that did a great job of this. I think there's this Peter Railton paper I used to teach on alienation. It's like on consequentialism and alienation. Those are two of the three words that are in the title, I think. And the idea is like this kind of theory, like that consequentialism, I think for Railton, he's like, it's clearly true, but it leads to this weird thing where we start like valuing our friend's happiness only because it sort of increases the sum total of pleasure, not because like, we value them, and it leads to a kind of alienation. And what happens, and he ends up giving this whole theory about how like, or this whole like spiel about how like, actually there is no separation really between you and me. And we're like always these dependent relational beings and actually all of this other stuff. And this is how we overcome the alienation. I could teach that in a class and students would be like, oh, I kind of get it. Right. Like there was something that kind of clicked for them. So there are some philosophers like that who I think in the analytic world who have done that very well. Railton's just the example that's coming to mind. Susan Wolf has that Moral Saints paper. People seem to really get it. You know, that seems to just immediately, they say, oh, interesting, because it actually affects how they would live their lives, right? Like, right. They're thinking about ethics and how they would live their lives. There's a shocking amount of stuff that could get written in ethics that the average person would read and would not know how to say, how does this change my life? Like, how does this change the way that I live or something like
right,
that?
Right.
Peter Singer is another exception just because like he'll that's tell you, he just tells you like the conclusion to this is to like stop eating meat. The conclusion, is to give all your money away. Like, you don't
and
see that.
He's so clear. And so he's like the favorite for like Christian apologists to kick around or for like the, you know, for whoever to pick
exactly. But like read a paper on like the nature of reasons, which is a fascinating topic. It was a topic that I was really interested in at one point, and even like for like a day thought I could write my dissertation on it. Because I always had this tendency when I was in the academy, when I was like thinking about potential dissertation projects, was like find the view that everyone mentions in their papers, but like dismisses immediately.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, that's the thing you should try to defend for a while. Right. So the degree theory of truth has like seven defenders. Right. So I thought, okay, I'll come up with a new version of that. And like reason internalism is just taken as like a given for a lot of people. It's not exclusively, but like hardcore reason externalism, I thought, yeah, I'll just become like the most vociferous reason externalist or something. That was like always kind of my thought here. But anyway, like those debates about reasons are like super interesting.
Yeah.
But could you explain the debate about like internal and external reasons to someone who's just like not ever taken a philosophy class, but says they might be interested in philosophy? And then you have to use like the Bernard Williams example of like, should the man stop beating his wife or something like that?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, and by the way, Bernard Bloom says he doesn't have a reason to stop being, you know, you know what I mean? Like, there's a bridge that needs to be crossed.
You're totally right, man. And that's part. So getting into public philosophy, I realized that my podcast, I meant it to be for my audience or for my friends, for my family. I work as a campus minister. So the guys I disciple, and it just didn't happen at all. And I would go so deep with like Timothy Williamson, and I'm like, sorry guys, we're going to talk about like, was Mars always dry or not dry? And we're going to get into vagueness. So I realized like, well, I need to do something different and do a midway between this. And so I started this Park Notes channel trying to lure people in. I want to like lure them in with some kind of, you know, we could talk about Mars first and then maybe get in the problem of vagueness. And the hard thing is you can't go in that the analytic lives in your head and is like, there's all these counterexamples. And you're like, well, if I spent time on those, this is going to be an hour instead of 15 minutes and no one's going to like it anymore. And so it's just hard to say, if you're listening, like, here's the paper, I'll point you to that, go read that, but I can't do it all.
Mm-hmm. And there's something to this, like, I very rarely touch on what you might call like typical analytic topics on my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Basically at all. And in fact, I simplify a lot of things when I talk about philosophy. You know, my YouTube channel is not totally just about philosophy. It's about books in general and stuff. Yeah. But when I talk about philosophy, how often do I do like a really rigorous run through of an argument? Almost never.
Right.
And in part because I kind of see this as like, one, there are other people who are going to do that and want to take the time and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sort of a volume content creator in the sense that I just put a lot of stuff out. And that's just like one way to do it, right? And then another thing though is that like I kind of actually see my content as like a first step into getting into philosophy if you've never taken a philosophy class.
Yeah,
that's why I talk about like philosophy for beginners a lot or something
that's
like
good.
This.
That's good.
I want my fans to outgrow me when they discover like more rigorous philosophy.
Yeah.
I enjoy the discussions that I have. I like the stuff I do, but if you get really into like some topic, then you will probably find someone else who is better suited to talk you through that topic. Mm. And I think that's a perfectly fine way to be in this ecosystem.
Yeah.
It's probably why I've been able to grow pretty quickly. And also though, it does lead to some criticism. You know, I think some philosophers say like, he barely goes into any detail. He's like very vague about stuff. That's to some extent true. Some people want to say that I have been called a pseudo intellectual.
See, that's why I wanted to talk about your logic work. Cause it's not true. Like you have the chops to do it. It's just like, if imagine you going over, you know, like two-dimensional semantics and stuff, it's just, there's going to be three people that watch it and that's not your project. And so I wanted to just at least show people like, yeah, you're pretty hardcore on this stuff. You just aren't, that's not what you're doing on your YouTube channel.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of it's just like, just know your audience and stuff. There's also like an autobiographical part that's important there though, which is that I never like loved the history of philosophy when I was in grad school or like when I was in college. I was always like a puzzle first kind of philosopher, you could say. Like I wanted this,
totally.
Give me like a metaphysical puzzle and I'll try to figure out ways to solve it. That was always like the kind of stuff that I was interested
that's
in.
Kind of an analytic like characterization, like that's analytics are called ahistorical for that reason, right?
I was like a very stereotypical analytic philosopher in this regard, right? There are plenty of people who are exceptions. I was not one, right? there was like a few exceptions in the history of philosophy that I found interesting. I really liked reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics when I took this like seminar on it. That comes up on my channel a lot. But when I left the academy, the puzzles seemed a little less interesting to me, and they just didn't seem like the kind of thing that could like motivate me to keep reading a lot of philosophy on my own.
Yeah.
And I just started reading more in the history of philosophy and like filling in gaps that had been left out in my education. You know, I didn't have like a bad education there. I started my PhD actually at Boston University, which is like a very heavy history department. And so I took history classes. I took seminars on Hegel. I took seminars on the history of analytic philosophy. I took, you know, Hume and, you know, all these other things. I took a great Hume seminar when I was at UConn with Don Baxter. But I just hadn't like loved history in a way that really kind of changed for me actually once I left the academy. And I just started reading more history. And I've come to believe that, especially for self-taught beginners, history is actually probably the best way to get them to read more philosophy. It latches onto big names that they are interested in anyways. And I kind of view it as like a life mission at this point to get people to stop being afraid of these texts.
Yeah.
Like one criticism I got early on when I would make these like philosophy books for beginners videos, and you know, you have to understand, I made this book, this one video called like 8 philosophy books you should read or you need to read or something like this. Terribly made. I just grabbed the books that I thought looked good off of my shelf. I had like 100 subscribers when I made that video. It now has like 500,000 views or something or something absurd, right?
Yeah.
I had no idea that that video would take off. My like first 2 videos on YouTube are in the hundreds of thousands of views.
Yeah.
I just got like stupid lucky there. There was nothing about, and they don't deserve it. Like the quality's bad. I don't understand it. And people were like, how could you possibly recommend Being in Time to a beginner? One, I did not recommend Being in Time as your first book to philosophy. I actually recommend it sequentially. And two, I think Heidegger's easier to read than people say. Not that he's easy to read, but that, for instance, Heidegger provides definitions of a lot of his terms. This is a common criticism that uses these terms and no one understands. Heidegger defines his terms often. You have to almost read him like you read a math textbook, where they don't remind you of the definition every time they use it. You go back and look for it. That takes work. But my view is that like you could do it if you actually wanted to read it, right?
Yeah.
Similarly, like someone even said like recommending Plato for beginners was too hard, which is just total BS. Like
it's weird.
It's obviously not. I've taught intro classes with Plato and they're basically dialogues. Hand them to your friends and act them out if you really want to like understand them. Listen to them on audiobook with different voice actors. Those exist. There's all these different ways you could consume this. And that basically anyone who has like some level of college education, maybe even a high school education with some work, could read many, if not most, of these texts. Would some of them go over your head? Absolutely. There are some that would go over my head too.
Yeah.
But we build up this weird stigma. That's why you always have to put for beginners or something in a video to tell someone like, oh, I promise you can do it.
Yeah.
I recommend hard books on purpose because I think almost anyone could do it if they're willing to put in the time.
I think there's I'm sorry, man. Yeah, go ahead.
The amount of time you might have to put in is different than the amount of time someone else has to put in.
Yes.
That's something you're going to have to figure out.
Yeah.
And for me, that's different too, right? I find certain philosophers very easy to read. If I were to, I've tried and failed to understand Hegel many times. And he's just someone that if I really wanted to read him, I feel like I'd have to set aside a year. I'm going to read the Phenomenology and the Science of Logic in that year. And I'm going to read like 5 companion books and that's all, right?
My
reading list is going to get obliterated if I do that. Right. But that would be fine if I really thought reading Hegel was super important for my life.
I think another stigma, I don't know why people think this, but they think that if you read a book once, like you can master a book by reading it once, or you can totally get it. It's like, why do you think that? Like I did this whole episode on marginalia and why you should write in your books. And it's because it's for future Parker. Like I'm not going to probably get all this. Oh, I'm definitely not going to get all this. My pride is getting in the way. I'm not going to get this first step, but I can leave myself breadcrumbs and help myself on the second, third, fourth, fifth time. And I got that from C.S. Lewis and saying like, you have to read a book more than once. And then the primary text is another thing that he talks about in intro to like on the incarnation, I think. And he says, you can do this. You don't have to be nervous. And actually a lot of times the secondary texts are harder to read than the primary.
Yeah, absolutely. They're going to be much more technical usually about things. They're going to be less fun probably. Yeah. And you have to admit that there's a certain level of enjoyment to reading that's going to make it easier for you to keep flipping the page.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer. Every time I've given sort of advice for reading in videos or something, I say two times is kind of the minimum. It doesn't have to be back to back. It's not like you finish the book once and you flip it over, right? It's also why I actually say that you should not make too many notes. You should make some, though, like what you think is important.
What you think is important,
what you don't understand, write little notes like that, because you're leaving room for your future self to add notes as well. But that's you know, we could quibble. But my point is just like marginalia is actually a signpost for you later.
Yeah.
Totally. Because sometimes you're going to read that book and you're going to say, I didn't understand that. Like, what do you mean? Right. Or I thought this was a good point. This is a terrible point. Like, because actually you change between readings of text and how you then engage with the text is going to change too. So there's so much to just like reading it more than once and just getting over this idea that if you don't understand the first time, you're like a fool or a moron or it's a bad book. That's the normal state of affairs for anything that's like really worth reading, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So just be okay with it. Just accept it.
Yeah. That's one of the benefits of actually studying philosophy in the academy, I'd say, is that you have friends, sometimes enemies in your class. And some, for whatever reason, they can understand this text better. And you're in philosophy of technology and you have to read Heidegger and your friend just gets challenging forth. And you're like, dude, what is he saying? He's talking about things thinging. And they're like, oh, here, let me help you explain. And then the next time you explain to them because whatever historical reasons or the way you're constituted at the moment, you can understand and they can't. And that's one thing I have really benefited being in the academy versus when I was just teaching myself.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to get that. I think one thing I would love to solve this problem in the future, which is how do you help people who aren't in the academy have those experiences?
Totally. Is the Discord working? Does that play that role?
A little bit. You know, I've got, I don't do a ton on the reading groups on my Discord just for time.
Sure.
But people organize them themselves.
Yeah.
And like we have a Chinese philosophy reading group going on in that group, which is not something I like know anything about. But one of the members has a PhD, has a master's, and he is thinking about a PhD, and he has done a ton of stuff on Chinese philosophy in his master's degree. So he's like, yeah, I'll lead the group, right? And then we have they meet, and you know it works. There's like always with reading groups, this is a constant thing. In the academy as well, just getting people to like stay committed to the whole thing. It's very common for the first meeting of a reading group to have 10 people, the last meeting of the reading group to have 2 people.
Yeah.
And there's a very steep drop off in the first like 4 weeks. So we're working on it. I'd like to maybe formalize it a little bit in the future to figure something out. I've thought about also doing like courses in the future, like, you know, charge some amount of money because I have to make it so that I actually am, like not spending my own money to do it or something like that.
And have buy-in too.
I actually do think asking someone to pay a certain amount of money that like stings a little, but not too much so that it can be accessible actually is important. Cause then you feel like you have to do this. As an example, I really decided this year I wanted to, especially after my son was born, I like wanted to get back into shape. I'd really let myself go while my wife was pregnant. And so like for the first time ever, I like found a trainer and I like committed to like 5 months of it and I paid it all up front. If I don't go, I just wasted a ton of money, right?
Totally.
And my thought is I can't miss a session now because I've already paid it. And I think there's something to that where it's like charge $50 to join or even 25 if someone can't afford it. You can work things out, right? But do like groups where maybe a lot of it is like reading on your own or something like this, but then I facilitate like some Zoom calls or something. The more I have to facilitate, frankly, the more I probably have to charge just because like it's more time, it's more organization and stuff. Right. But and nothing here is like set in stone. This is just kind of ideation. The idea, though, would be to find ways to get people interested.
Yeah.
There's this one organization that does this stuff really well, and they do it for free in a way that I really commend, called the Catherine Project. Zena Hitz, I believe, is the one who runs this. She wrote this great little book called Lost in Thought. And they run these reading groups where they have tutors that they're really selective about like which tutors they take. And you can sign up for free and you sign up to read like a great book for like 3 months. And, you know, we're going to read Moby Dick together. We're going to read Hume together. We're going to read this. And they seem to have a lot of success. In fact, I would highly recommend that people check out the Catherine Project. It's like a, like I'm very, like pleased to see something like that exist.
Yeah.
In the world. Zena is at St. John's. Great. It was fantastic. Great book school. And so she's kind of using the St. John's model, but bringing it to the masses. Mm. And they'll have like high school students who join, and they'll have like people in their 70s who join these, and they say the classes are great.
Wow, that's amazing. That's what a huge project. Wow.
Yeah, they have to like solicit donations. Like, I mean, I think for Zena, you know, she's a full-time professor, made some money from writing a popular book, but like she spends a lot of time as president of the Catherine Project just like fundraising.
Yeah,
you totally have to have this whole thing. But it's such a cool thing to see in the world.
I'd love
to solve some of those problems.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And that's I have for so long wanted to. I started out wanting to be like a public intellectual, and then I was like, "Ooh, that's pretty cringe to think of myself that way or call myself that." And then I got into I started studying academic philosophy. I studied on my own, and I was like, "Man, I'm awesome! I can learn everything myself." Got into the academy and realized like, "Wow, I didn't know anything." Now I want to be an intellectual, you know, in the academy, and then seeing like, "Whoa, I also want to have a reach. I want to teach people, and I want to have a general audience." So now getting into like public philosophy and seeing there's kind of, you mentioned already with academics, especially analytics right now, they talk about having a public facing philosophy and a peer facing philosophy. And I love these folks. They all come on my podcast. They're great. I love you guys. Please keep coming on. But a lot of times their idea of public facing philosophy is like, how do I stuff what I'm already been working on that the public doesn't care about into the public's like face? How do I get that? Instead of asking, what is the public interested in? How can I apply my work to those puzzles or those problems?
Yeah. Yeah. There are good examples. I mean, I know this guy very well. He was on my dissertation committee, so maybe that's not the best one we're going to pick. Sure. Michael Lynch is like a great example of this, in my opinion. Mm. So Michael wrote a book called The Internet of Us, where it was about like epistemology and stuff, but about the internet. And it was like a huge hit. It led him to like going to like the Aspen Ideas Festival and like a TED Talk and stuff like this.
Yeah.
You know, so that's like a good success. And he just wrote a book. I read it this weekend called Know It All Society. I think it came out like last year. Hmm. I've been meaning to write him an email to tell him all the things I liked and disliked about the book in like a very friendly fashion. But and I thought it was great. And it was about like truth and politics and like intellectual arrogance versus having intellectual commitments or moral commitments and how you can handle that in politics. And that's really consonant with a lot of stuff that Michael has been thinking about for years. He ran this thing through the Humanities Institute at UConn called the Public Discourse Project. I think that's what it ended up. It changed the name at one point. But anyway, and it was all about like social epistemology and politics and stuff like this.
Hmm.
He had a field day when everyone was talking about like fake news and post-truth because he'd worked on truth for so long. You know, he worked on that stuff, and it's translated really well. Michael is still very productive. I think he writes fewer academic articles now because he does so much public philosophy.
Yeah.
It's not like he's opted out. He still does it, but it's really hard to balance those two things.
Right.
Also, a lot of his time is like he runs the Humanities Institute at UConn, which has become this thriving thing. But it's really hard to do both, especially if they're not clearly aligned. Right.
Yeah.
I was looking at your channel. You had Jonathan Schaffer on, right? With someone else whose name I can't remember.
Yeah, Philip Goff. Yeah. Yeah.
Philip Goff. He just talked about like the nature of the mind, functionalism, stuff like that. I love that stuff. I read so much Jonathan Schaffer when I was at grad student. I got to see him give a talk on causation in quantum mechanics or something like this once about like the pointer and the wave and stuff. Like I loved it. I adored this stuff. It would be hard for him to write that stuff and then find like an audience for it.
Right.
No disrespect to it at all. It's great. But there's a certain public audience that wants that stuff. It's fairly small.
Yeah.
To estimate, I don't know, 5,000 people or something like this who would watch an episode. There's other work that you can do, like Michael, where he really leaned into like the politics side of stuff and like the political culture side of stuff. That opens up a wider avenue where he's been able to apply some of his philosophy stuff, but he really has to do a lot of work to translate the ideas into it. I'm trying to write a book and it would be very much like a public philosophy thing.
Okay.
And based on some stuff I do on the channel and stuff, it would not be about truth. It would not be about my former former academic work.
Yeah.
It would just be on some of these, some themes that have kind of emerged on my channel over and over again. That's not actually me like turning my back on the stuff I did in the academy. It's more that just actually my interests are more like I read the ancient Greeks more than anyone else at this point.
Yeah.
Which if you knew me in graduate school and you heard me say that, you would laugh. Like you'd be like, there's no way Jared does this stuff. Right. I basically have like really shifted my priorities, and that's changed how I like present things to the public.
Yeah. Well, so that's fascinating, man. I'm definitely gonna read that book. But I've been doing this through looking at the YouTube analytics and seeing like what's playing, what are people interested in, and a lot of them are interested in like Gödel's incompleteness theory theorems against computational theories of mind. I'm like, what? No, you guys don't know about this, but you put out one little video on it and it explodes. And you're like, okay, there's something in the algorithm or just the audience, and they love that kind of stuff. They love simulation hypothesis. They really love panpsychism. They love stoicism, and I wanted to ask you about that too. Like, there's certain things that just pop, and if you have been working in those in the academy, or if you're an epistemologist, and you've thought about brain innovat skepticism, like now is your time. Jump in on simulation hypothesis in a way that's a little bit accessible, you know, and pull them in. And so, I've just it's like a hobby horse of mine to say, how do we do public facing philosophy that actually takes some of the popular questions, philosophical questions of the public, and inject into them, you know, cutting edge work, because a lot of the sociologists, a lot of the psychologists, a lot of even like popular linguists are doing the work of the philosophers, and I'm jealous. I'm like, you guys, that used to be the role of the philosopher. Go take it back.
Yeah. So I think that the first thing you have to do probably is meet the public where they are.
Mm.
Meaning, what are they already interested in?
Yeah.
Okay. Like there's a certain contingent of people who would say this sounds very inauthentic or kind of mercenary almost to say this, but like, look, I want to talk to people about philosophy. What I have found is that oftentimes people will tolerate me talking about philosophy if I slip it into other stuff.
Yes. Yes.
One of my most popular videos is a video about journaling.
Yeah.
I don't know if you watch this one.
I've seen it.
How to journal like a philosopher.
Yeah, I came out with one a week before that, and it was eight ways to journal like a philosopher.
Yeah.
And it did really well for me. And then I saw yours, like, dang it.
That's my most successful video ever. I had 250,000 views in 2 weeks, which for me is absurd. Like, and I think currently it's like over 600,000. I think it will eventually be my first video to a million.
Totally.
You know, just like projecting here. It's a 6 minute video. About 2 minutes of it is really about journaling.
Mm-hmm.
Because I start by just like, look, journaling, all it is just like writing stuff down. And then I answer this practical question. What do you write about? Right. And I provide this method. Right. And I talk about like, write about something that went well, something that didn't go well. And then also try to like write a little paragraph about like, how is this like continuing the narrative of my life? Right.
Yeah.
And then I pivot really hard and I'm like, now I'm going to talk to you about narrative conceptions of the self.
Yeah, I love that.
And I'm going to talk to you about the idea from ancient philosophy that I drawing from Julia Onnes's book, The Morality of Happiness, about making sense of one's life as a whole. And I try to introduce you to the concept of eudaimonia or human flourishing, right? I have tricked 600,000 people into learning about eudaimonia.
Yes.
this is what you have to do. And none of them regretted it, right? It's not a bait and switch. I taught them a little bit about journaling, which is what they were interested in. And I taught them about philosophy up there, and it's in the title. Both of those things are in the title. Do I care about my journaling content as much? Like just like journaling for the sake of it. I think journaling is a very important practice. I think it's good. I want you to care about the philosophy, right? Like that's the thing. And I think that one of the things that I've done and that I will continue to do for quite a while is really lean into a certain audience that cares about like they would watch what we would call like self-improvement videos or like personal development videos or something like that, because actually especially the ancient philosophers had a lot of thoughts about those topics, but the answers that they would give to the questions people are asking are very different than what you would hear now.
Yeah. It's like so the I'm philosophy of, it. Yeah, philosophy as a way of life type stuff, right? And it's like, yeah, they've been saying this for a long time.
Exactly. I'm working on a video. I don't know when it will come out because it's going to be, I kind of have some ideas for how to make it like really good and it's going to take a while. But the potential title is going to be something like how to be happy, parentheses, like according to Aristotle. Nice. It's actually teaching you about Aristotle. It's actually teaching you about Nicomachean Ethics, which is like my favorite book. But it's starting with this question of like people want to know how to be happy. That's why the self-improvement industry is I looked this up. Like McKinsey did a study on like the wellness industry, which includes like physical wellness, but also like spiritual or mental wellness or something like this. Yeah. It's in like the trillions of dollars, like, wow. like annually, yeah. and they just project it to grow, right? People want to ask those questions. They're getting sold really bad answers.
Yeah.
The power of positive thinking, or you're just like one skincare routine away from solving all your problems or something
right.
like this,
right.
or you need to accumulate masses of wealth. You know, it's those kinds of questions that I really want to push, those kinds of answers I really want to push back against, while saying that the question you're asking is a legitimate one,
mm-hmm.
that you're not stupid or weird or vain for wondering how to make yourself a better person.
Right. Yeah. And that's
I'm
a
not
self-help.
An expert on that either. Right. Yeah. So that's why I appeal to
pilgrim along the way. And I think that helps too, because you can see, you'll show like a notebook and be like, look, this is from 2010. And it's like, oh, so this isn't something you just picked up in order to make a video. This is your lifestyle. And I started my channel and then I found you and I was like, oh dude, we're like kindred spirits here. And I saw like commonplace books. I'm like, dude, I've been keeping commonplace books since 2010. I didn't know people like these. And so then I made a video about commonplace books and two ways that I use them. One's a compendium, one's a commonplace book. And then I slipped in some philosophy and I'm talking about machine functionalism. I'm like, surprise, you guys didn't know that, but you're getting some machine functionalism in here today. And I love the way you do it. I love because it's not bait and switch, but it is drawing them into deeper philosophy and self-mastery through like self-help. And self-help's like a dirty word in a lot of academic circles. She's like, it's a self-help book. It's like, dude, people need help. And just because it's like this is what else? Like bring them into philosophy, theology, like good stuff, good answers.
The Epictetus's Enchiridion is a self-help book.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. And also if you look in like the history of the world has these manuals for better living. You find them in the Christian tradition. St. Augustine has like an one that's often just called his Enchiridion. These manuals for daily life or something like this that are supposed to like lead to spiritual flourishing.
Yeah.
You'll find them all over the place in history. People have seen that writing these sorts of things is actually useful.
Yeah.
The reason that self-help has a bad reputation now is frankly because there's so many of those books, so much of that content, and so much of it is awful.
Yeah.
So much of it is just like stuff that sounds good. It's empty platitudes that doesn't actually speak to like the fundamental issues
here.
Or even if there is a good idea, how often can it be so quickly co-opted into something else? Think about like minimalism as a trend. In the book I'm writing, I plan to write like a very long part about minimalism.
Huh.
When you read those original minimalists, they're talking about how like we overconsume. It's bad for us. It's bad for the environment. It's going to be a burden on our families when we die. So the first step is to get rid of stuff. And the next step is to not buy new stuff. And then to find happiness in activities, right? Who else says that happiness is an activity? Aristotle, you know, like, you know, say, like, yeah. like to find it in relationships, right? Or experiences. You can like, that's a, that there's like a lot of good messages to that, right? Minimalist very quickly became a marketing trend where you would get rid of all your stuff and then you would buy the minimalist version of it. I threw away my vase because I don't need a vase, but now I've bought a minimalist vase, so it's okay, right?
Yeah.
And like how quickly that happened, like that stuff happened. And so even the good ideas get co-opted very, very, very quickly. I wish though that people could ask those questions. How do I change my relationship to material goods? Like that is actually a philosophical question that has been relegated to the world of self-help in a way that makes us feel very odd to then ask it. But read the Meditations by Marcus Aurelius and you will see lots of stuff about material goods. You read Epictetus, read Aristotle. Aristotle disagrees with the Stoics about how much about material goods in the good life. That's an interesting question. How much material comfort does one need to actually live a good life? Ascetic traditions in both the East and the West, I mean East very broadly here have very different views about this stuff too. So that's like an open question. What kind of material comfort do I need to live a good life? Yeah. And a philosopher could write about that. And like, that's one of the things I want to write about, or I want to introduce to people. But if you wrote it like that, imagine a YouTube video that says, what is material comfort? Or like, why do you need material goods to be happy? Or something like that.
Yeah.
Seven people would click on it, right?
Yeah.
But put it in terms of, you know, why minimalism failed or something like that.
Yeah.
Suddenly that's a very YouTube friendly kind of title, but you can talk about the same stuff.
Right. Yeah, dude, that's so good. It's really encouraging to me that you're doing this, because people are really hungry for it. Like, people go to like Jocko Willink, and I like Jocko Willink. I think he's awesome. He's awesome. He's great. So I don't want to like poo-poo him or anything, but I started my podcast because I wanted philosophers and theologians to have more of a public impact. I like their works, and I'm like, let's get this out to the rest of the public. And it's not like, I'm not Lex Friedman, but at least some more people are seeing it. And so I'm really excited to see that you're just exploding here, and especially as like a first step into philosophy. And my goal with my other channel, I just thought of it as we're talking, but that's like a second step. Like, yeah, I'm going to keep passing you on to the third step. And then, you know, eventually we'll keep going, and you'll be blaming us when you're working on your PhD with no job prospects.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. Man. So, we don't have a whole ton of time to talk about sci-fi, but you're into sci-fi and you do a lot with sci-fi. And I wanted to get your take. How come the sci-fi folks, are able to get philosophy into the public so much better than philosophers?
I think the answer there is pretty simple. They just can tell very good stories along the way, right? And it's like, it can be thrilling or it can be intriguing. There's like mystery in a lot of sci-fi novels. People like talk about, they love the world for the world building, right? They're like the little book fair, which is like slowly revealed to you, and then you have to like think about it. And philosophers mostly train on how to be like very clear and how to present your ideas so that no one misses them. This is a virtue in philosophy. It's a good thing to do when you're writing philosophically. But that does not always translate, or does not always immediately mean that you're also writing in a way that hooks someone. Yeah. Because oftentimes, actually, people are hooked by ambiguity. They just want you to resolve the ambiguity by the end, right? So, so science fiction writers, the good ones, can present a very good idea by presenting a science fiction writers can present a very good idea by putting it into an interesting world that kind of gets you thinking. Also, in a way, you might even put it as like that the world itself can be like embodying the philosophical ideas.
Yeah, that's a good
point. In a way, the best versions of this, like what I call like philosophical science fiction on my channel, isn't like two philosophers having a philosophical debate.
Right.
It's not like that. Like, that's not what you do. Neal Stephenson sometimes does that, but that's a little bit different. He also puts it into the world in a way that matters to the plot. Mm-hmm. And so that gets you thinking about those ideas kind of as they lived out in these characters' lives or in the events of the book. And that hooks people, right? That's like, people like stories. And we should be cool with people liking stories. And we should want to bring stories to them.
Yeah, like in Out of the Silent Planet, Lewis, that's a really good, you just brought it up in my head. The aliens are like the tripartite of the soul. And there's the Fifeltrigi and the Sorns, and they all represent different aspects. I think Frank Herbert like did more for my meta philosophy than any philosopher ever has in the Dune Messiah. He talks about the Zensuni Mentat, and he's like, the Mentat's like the analytic philosopher, and the Zensuni's like the continental, I'm saying in my head.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, I want to be a Zensuni Mentat. And so like, that's, I'm making a video on that, because I'm like, let's see if we can lure, you know, all the sci-fi folks into the analytic continental divide and explain some stuff. Jared, this has been awesome, man. Thanks so much for your time. I hope this is just like the start of something. I'd love to have you back on. Thanks for the work you're doing. If you guys are watching this video, I'm sure you've already heard of Jared, but check out his YouTube channel. It's just called Jared Henderson.
Just called Jared Henderson, yeah.
And then how about your Substack?
Also, there's just jaredhenderson.substack.com. On there, I do been doing a read through of the Meditations, Marcus Aurelius. On that part's totally free. And then I write some occasional essays for people behind the paywall if you're interested in supporting me or something like that, which just helps, you know, keep the channel going and stuff.
Totally. That's awesome. Yeah. All right, man. Well, that's awesome. Folks, that's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensies. And as always, all glory to God.